Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this episode of A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. Yes, we have insightful legal minds. We have enlightening legal minds, and I'm so excited to speak with you all today. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. But all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for the racist conduct often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. Let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. Yes, my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am your host for tonight's show of A Time for Justice. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we have such an exciting show tonight. I am very excited, actually, by the title of our show, because tonight we have three panelists who will participate in our roundtable discussion. And these panelists helped me to come up with the title, which is A Black Man's View from the Courtroom and What You Should Know. Yes, we will have three dynamic Black men who are attorneys in this country, and they're going to discuss with us these issues. As a background, I'd like to say that a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. And that is a quote from an attorney a long time ago by the name of Charles Hamilton Houston. And we're going to talk about the events that we've seen since Michael Brown's murder and the revealing of the systemic racism that has been just underneath the surface or really blatantly in the faces of Black people all too long. We've seen the police shootings. We've seen the over-policing. We've been the victims of these incidents. And so now we're seeing prosecutors and municipalities with civil rights violations, officers, the plight of America's Black youth, and just all types of violations. And these brothers, I think it's very, very important to say that the brothers that I'm going to introduce to you who are Black lawyers, they've been standing up for justice in courts across America. And I want you all to understand that a Black attorney in America's courts, they're walking into hostile environments where race is a factor. And there's been years of oppression done under the law and excused by the law. So Black men, they have a very unique perspective because we know Black men's rights haven't been respected, Black women, Black children, and just overall disenfranchisement by the law. And so I want, before I bring them up, I want to say that as Black lawyers, they know the greatness. and the future of black people, because this is who they are. This is the communities that they come from, and they know the abilities of these black men and women that oftentimes we see in the court, and oftentimes we see these people painted, our people, painted with the broad brush and negative light. Because, yes, black lawyers are painted sometimes in a negative light too, and all too often it is not deserving, because we work hard, they work hard. So I want to bring these brothers up without further ado. And the first person I want to bring up is our brother by the name of Deshaun Muhammad. And brother Deshaun Muhammad has been a practicing attorney since 2001. He's coming out of the Memphis, Tennessee area, and I believe also the Mississippi border, which is South Haven. And over the years, this brother has practiced law all over the state of Tennessee on a broad range of cases. He is a former Chancery Court Special Master for Shelby County, Tennessee. While he has tried many cases, both criminal and civil, he found that his passion is in cases involving children and families. He has been an attorney for the Tennessee Department of Children's Services, representing countless children in delinquency, child abuse, custody cases, and family law. He also tells us that he is a husband and a father of a toddler. He's a Chicago native. He attended Rust College as an undergrad and graduated from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. He is presently a partner. He works in the office of John T. Williams, PLLC. So let me go ahead and bring in Brother Deshaun. Brother Deshaun, your mic is open. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, sister. How are you?
Oh, I am fine. Thank you so much, Brother Deshaun, for coming on our show. It is such an honor to have you here. The next attorney that I would like to bring up is an attorney by the name of Gerald T. Christmas. Now, Attorney Gerald Christmas is a community activist, and he's a veteran litigator with over 20 years of experience. He focusing on criminal defense, personal injury, and civil rights litigation. Gerald has a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, having worked with juveniles and adults in the criminal justice system. Mr. Christmas actually worked in juvenile detention facilities. He's been a parole officer in the state of Georgia. He's been a municipal prosecutor, and he actually was a St. Louis assistant circuit attorney for 7 years, prosecuting drug, assault, and sex crime cases. Gerald, also an astute politician, ran for the St. Louis Circuit Attorney. He's worked on a number of other state and local political campaigns, assisting Claire McCaskill in the United States Senate. And also, Gerald Attorney Christmas is a 1994 graduate of Texas Southern University, Thurgood School of Law, Thurgood Marshall School of Law. And he has deep ties to the city of St. Louis. Brother Christmas is a member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, Inc., 100 Black Men, past president of the Mountain City Bar Association. And Mr. Christmas also is married and has 4 daughters. So let me bring Attorney Christmas into this conversation. Let me open his mic. Attorney Christmas, are you?
I'm here.
Excuse me?
How you doing?
All right.
I'm here.
I'm fine. Okay. Well, welcome.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Sam. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I am so excited to have you on the show. And we have one more attorney, and that is Brother Jimmy Morris. And Brother Jimmy texted me earlier to say, as most attorneys sometimes run into, he's in court still. So he's running. I think he's going to join us later. But we're going to get started with our show tonight with these two brothers. And I really wanted to say, you know, having black men on the show puts me in the mindset of Father's Day, because all too often we're not giving you all the notice and the credit that you deserve because you work very hard as fathers, you know, as your older families. You work very hard in these courts. So I want to personally say thank you very much. And I also want to bring to mind the Million Man March, because for me, the Million Man March is some context for tonight's show, because you all, and I know Attorney Christmas and Brother Deshaun, you are in the nation. You're a registered member of the Nation of Islam. So the minister, Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, is someone that you, I know, you know, you're very familiar with the teachings. But the Million Man March brought Christians and Muslims and brothers across the country and the world to one point where they wanted to look at the issues, the problems of the black community, and took that responsibility and pledge to make their communities better. And so for that, I want to give you all, again, another congratulations and, you know, want to honor you all for all the work that you do. And so, like I said, you know, you all are lawyers, and you come into contact with mainly a lot of black men and women facing charges, and I want to talk about the challenges and consequences that you all see. I want you all to give us some fatherly wisdom, because it's unique in this system where, first off, we know the system is filled with white people, white perspective. 88% of lawyers, they say, are white, and only 4.8% are black attorneys. And so that kind of sets up the conversation about the lack of neutrality, because when I look at the problem of racism, so many times we look at the system, but we got to look at the people. You know, the system is the laws and the people who make and enforce them. So with over 88% of white lawyers, with one study showing us that they have a problem with neutrality, you know, to put it bluntly, the study shows that white attorneys have biases that result in less favorable outcomes for black clients. I mean, this is the result of a study. You know, their lack of neutrality undermines their ability, this is white lawyers' ability to provide for black clients. It undermines their lack of neutrality. So, again, bias exists across the legal practice. This is what a study is telling us. You know, when white lawyers look at black clients, they had 20 white lawyers interview, 19 admitted that in deciding to reject or take a case, they look at the client's ability to pay. And, you know, we don't, black people overall, we have the lower income. But they also look at demeanor and mannerisms, which they say is often coded language for racial characteristics. So I want to know from you all, what does that look like? You know, judges, 7% of judges are black. And judges do impact on how cases and trials and outcomes come out based on these judges. So, again, we're looking at racism in the system, but we're really looking at racism in people. So I want to ask, what is the role that race plays in the different segments of the law, police interrogations, interviews, grand jury outcomes? And Attorney Christmas, I'm going to start with you because I know that you were a former prosecutor, and you can tell us about grand jury and how that operates. We know Breonna Taylor and the no-knock warrant. So Attorney Christmas, are you available to share that information with us? How does that work, the grand jury process, and is race a factor?
I think race is always a factor, especially in the criminal justice system, Sister Pam. And for many individuals, when they think about the grand jury system, what they don't understand is that the grand jury is an arm of the prosecution. Prosecutor has two ways in Missouri in order to get an indictment, meaning formal charges. The way that our system works is that an independent body needs to look at the prosecutor's decision to determine if they have probable cause to move forward. Not guilt or innocence, but probable cause. And you know, all of us on here, that probable cause is a very low burden to meet. They can either do that in a preliminary hearing, which is done in public, and the defense is there along with the prosecution, and the judge determines if there's probable cause. Or they can take more sensitive cases or cases that they deem that they want to take to the grand jury because it's their discretion to the grand jury, and the grand jurors will vote on whether or not it's probable cause. But the difference is that in the grand jury, nobody is there but the prosecution. And that's why it's such an arm of the prosecution, because the defense is not there. You're not allowed to be present. It's a secret proceeding. It's not determining guilt or innocence. It's only determining if there's probable cause to move forward. So anytime you hear situations like in Michael Brown where the prosecutor's office says that the grand jury elected not to indict, that's because the prosecution didn't want an indictment. And oftentimes they will use the grand jury as cover for them, because they'll say, well, the grand jury has decided not to indict, but you're the only one that's presented evidence to the grand jury. And so you have a significant amount of influence. When I worked in the prosecutor's office, I served as grand jury attorney for a term, and the grand jury did whatever I wanted them to do. If I didn't like the case, the grand jury didn't like the case. If I liked the case, they did. There's nobody in there but me and the grand jury and the witnesses I decided to call. So if there's not an indictment through the grand jury, it's because the prosecutor didn't want an indictment.
Interesting. Interesting, because we see in the Final Call newspaper this week, there's an article, a black man with mental illness is dead, but there's no indictment. And so that's the case of Mr. Scott, who was restrained to a bed, sprayed with pepper spray, and placed a spit mask over his face in Collin County. But he ended up dead. He was then taken to the hospital after being restrained. He became unresponsive. And again, the public is saying that why was there no indictment? So what you're explaining gives us some background on how that process can sometimes work, right?
And especially in cases,
sir,
involving law enforcement like that, where the prosecutor is hesitant to bring the charges and they don't want to take the heat of saying that they're not going to charge. So therefore, they bring it before a grand jury and they present it in a way that the grand jurors are influenced not to indict. That happened here in St. Louis with the Michael Brown case, where they let the officers come in and the defendant. They let the defendant come in and testify before the grand jury. And under normal circumstances, that never happens. But whenever you're dealing with law enforcement, things always get flipped over and handled in a different way. But under normal circumstances, a defendant will never testify before the grand jury.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. And Brother Deshaun, I'm going to ask you the actual question about race being a factor. But, you know, with police interrogations, potentially, as a juvenile lawyer and attorney general, you can weigh in as well. But there's a new case that out of Illinois in the Final Call reporting lying and locking up children. And there's a new law that talks about this lying and this coercive behavior that's going on in interrogating children, and now that is being prohibited. Is that something, Brother Deshaun, that we've seen and that race is a factor in those cases? What do you think?
I agree with Attorney Christmas. Race is always a factor in the legal system. Most of the officers that I deal with will claim that they have not lied to juveniles. But when I talk to the family, they always recount a story that's very different from what reality is. And they can say that the officer who seemed like their friend told them thus and such was what happened. But I can say that I've seen race as an attorney, I've seen race become a factor even from people who didn't realize what they were doing. It's always involved because when I was in law school, we actually had a clinic that allowed us to try criminal cases. And I had one prosecutor who was a very aggressive prosecutor. He always in my cases, he always sought the higher sentence for the individual. My cases tended to be, the clinic usually took in poor people. My clients usually were Black. I had one case with an individual who was charged with stealing a police car, driving drunk, nearly running over an officer because he was drunk. That individual walked with a, what in Iowa at the time, I believe the charge was joyriding, which was a misdemeanor. Tutor's reasoning for offering the child, well, I say child, he was 17, but he could have been charged as an adult. The prosecutor's reasoning is he reminded him of himself when he was a child because he was a blonde, blue-eyed individual. And so this person who normally would seek the highest charge he could saw himself. And that I found is often a reality. We don't look like the person that they see every morning when they get up. And our people often suffer because of that.
And I think that's a real valid point, because when I worked in a prosecutor's office, you would find the white prosecutors would all of a sudden find compassion for white defendants that I never saw them show for Black defendants. And that always was an issue for me. And I just wanted to add, do you find that they take more advantage of juveniles? Because I find that the school-to-prison pipeline is real. And I've represented a few juveniles here in the St. Louis metropolitan area, and I always have to caution parents to tell their children, do not make any statements. Have your children not make any statements to principals or teachers or anyone. Just train your students, train your children to say, not to be rude, but I love to talk to you. I just need you to call my parents first. Because many Black parents, their children will be on the way to juvenile before they're notified. And I just wanted to know if that was you all's experience with the juveniles, too. I just see them taking more advantage of Black juveniles lately.
Yep. But, Deshaun, did you want to add on that?
Most definitely. In two ways, I see that as an issue. Because the first one is, oftentimes, we will give a statement, or the parent will convince the child to give a statement, you know, believing it'll teach the child a lesson.
Right.
Not comprehending that this is not discipline. This is not the place to deal for discipline, because this is a hostile environment. And so I often have to tell, often have to tell families that this is not put together to help you parent your child. This is punishment. This is something very different. And we have to treat it as such. So I have to often have to do exactly what you said. I just tell my clients flat out to shut up.
Right.
Because if they don't, their lives are at risk. And you know, that's a big part of it is getting people to be quiet.
That's an excellent point. I'm gonna steal that one. Because I forget to tell them. Because oftentimes you do have parents who feel like that they're teaching the children a lesson, but they don't understand how detrimental that is, and this is not the time to do that. That is an outstanding point. I had to remember that. I'm going to make a note of that one.
Right, and I think it's so important, and that's why we're doing these conversations, because it's all about knowing your rights, because this is constitutional law 101. A person who is accused of a crime has that certain right, and it is one of the rights. And we can go into Derek Chauvin's conviction as an example of how everybody has a right to a trial, and everybody has a right to make the prosecution prove a case. So it's not like you're not being friendly by, you know, not making your child cooperate. You're just participating in a system, and as you all say, it's a very hostile environment and it has rules. So I'd like to go into the recent conviction of Derek Chauvin, and there is a Final Call article that talks about how people, the conviction made people feel deep distrust following this particular conviction and some of what we saw. And I want to say before we get into it, to the listeners, we will take calls, we'll take questions. If you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. But did we see race as a factor in Derek Chauvin's sentencing? Anybody want to, you know, chime in on that? I would like to hear what we thought about that conviction as attorney.
Right before you go to that, did mm-hmm. the sign have a second point on the juveniles? Because I like that first one. I thought I missed the second one.
Oh,
okay.
I'm sorry. The second point I was going to make, and I just recalled what it was. When we were talking about race in the juvenile system, the biggest place that I've seen race involved is who actually gets charged. It doesn't matter what the offense is. If it never makes it in front of the judge, then the effect is, of course, going to be different. I've seen so many cases over the years that I find out about that were dealt with internally by the court for little Caucasian children, and the black child is automatically put on the track to go in front of the judge because, of course, they're going to be fair. And that's one place where the statistics can't really show it. You have to see it because there's no real statistic to say how many people never were officially charged, how many people had some off the books, some alternative sentence that was developed by the court personnel or by the court officers.
That's absolutely true. Not to mention the people that just don't get charged, period, that the police decide to escort home or the prosecutor's office elects not to bring any charges, period.
Yeah.
There's no way to account for that. And that happens significantly because that's very important, especially in the prosecutor's office, who's working in the warrant office. Because I know when I worked in a warrant office and a police officer would bring in a case, because I'm black and I understand the community much better, I can have a different perspective on what the witnesses were saying and the different questions that I asked. Because I really tried to get to the truth of what happened.
Right.
And you're not going to get that from the white community because they're just the passion for – nobody is going to have the same passion for your people that you do. Like, nobody loves your children more than you do, you know?
That's right. That is so right. Right, and that's what these pretext stops a lot of times are about, right? You know, black person, like it said, the white lawyer said your demeanor and your mannerisms. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that you smiled? Does that mean you had a hat? What does that mean? So this is what we're being wrongfully interpreted in these courts.
Sister Pam, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead. Yes, sir. You take the flow.
You asked what the relevance of having black attorneys was. There was a recent case dealt with by one of the state Supreme Courts, but the big issue was it was a criminal case. And the individual was said to have given a statement. His statement was given, it was a black man who gave the statement, and he was speaking with slang. His slang was something like, somewhere or another he said, yeah, dog, or something like that in his statement, and I don't remember the exact wording. But because his statement was given, and he was speaking slang at the time, the transcript went all the way up to the state Supreme Court or wherever, and they basically upheld his conviction because the exact language that he used was used against him. As in, if he had an attorney who could speak the same language that he used, it could have been corrected on the front end, and the record would have would have basically exonerated him. But that was the reality of the type of, in truth, the type of nonsense that we face, is that when we don't deal with persons who come from our same environment, we have that reality. They don't necessarily take the time to address those issues.
Right, and that's an excellent point, because one of my points and questions is, we got to let people know that they should hire black lawyers, despite the fact that this is a predominantly white system. There's a fallacy out here that you should hire white attorneys and that somehow you're going to get favorable, but that's not true, because what happens is that black lawyers fight for you. What the brothers are saying, black lawyers care about you. And as you all noted, you see yourselves in the people that are coming into the courtrooms, and that is so important to note. So I think that's an excellent point you brought up about understanding the culture. Brother Gerald, did you have anything you wanted to add about that? Because you live in a city that is got a lot of racism. You know, this is a city where Dred Scott's decision is the landmark decision. We know Ferguson came out of that city, and a lot of the pretextual stops that really led to Michael Brown's murder happened right in that city. So in looking at what Brother Deshaun said is nonsense, do you see a lot of that nonsense, you know, or racism masquerading as nonsense when it comes to how they look at black people in the legal system?
It's not masquerading. We have a significant amount of, I mean, it's in the open. You know, St. Louis is real oppressive, and it's right at the border. See, the issue is that St. Louis is right at the border. Illinois is a free state. It's the river that divides us. So St. Louis was the last stronghold. And, you know, when you develop a last stronghold mentality, you know, it's like, you're extra focused on maintaining the Confederacy because you are the last stands. Once they pass you, they're free. And you got to hold the line hard here because past you, that's it. And that's this culture that has developed here, which is why people don't understand that, but that's what makes it so unique. So the pressure here is greater, and the white people are more accustomed to applying harder pressure because it's the stronghold.
Okay.
And it would be if anyone was in that stronghold position. And so that's the battle we face, and that's why when people leave here and you go to Houston or you go to Dallas or you go to Atlanta or you go to Charlotte or Phoenix or the D.C. or Philly or down in Carolinas or Florida, you realize these places have issues, but they don't have to be as hard as here. And that's why they don't come back. You all, like yourself, Sister Pam, you concerned and you come home and your family's here and you love them, but you're not trying to live here again. And so that leaves us in a deficit here. And then for the attorneys, how that weaves in. So, you know, we're in the court fighting those battles. And I think we have a good crop of black attorneys here. We have a lot of, you know, a lot of us from Texas Southern, HBCUs, Thurgood Marshall, you know, we represent well in St. Louis. The mistake that we're making is that we are not practicing cooperative economics. So we're having the issue. We're having the same issue that the rest of the community is having, too, about being able to cooperate together economically. It has more significant effect because of, you know, the ability that we have as black lawyers to make a difference and do other things and also generate income. So it's more severe when we have it because we are wasting more resources by having that mentality than somebody with less resources. So what we have need to focus on is coming together. And we're getting there. It's like a slow art, you know, because we don't have any black law firms in St. Louis. And we don't have a lot of major black law firms across the country. Many of us in private practice, you know, you in private practice. I'm guilty of it, too. I'm not pointing no fingers. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, it's a deprogramming. It's a real deprogramming, and we are in the process of doing that, but we need to speed it up. The other thing, my grandmother always said, a lump of coal don't become a diamond without pressure. And so the pressure that they put on us is forcing us to do it. So in some ways, I guess it's just the natural order of the universe. You know, they put the pressure on you, you're going to have to perform, and that's where we're at right now. That's the point we are right now. We're on the cusp of that with our race, and it's which way we're going to go. And I understand, I think people should be free to live their lives the way that they want to, but it needs to be with respect and decency.
Yeah, because
it's,
I did see it. And I think one of the things you're mentioning, because as lawyers, there is pressure. I read in a study to be colorblind. You know, they like to claim that lawyers, we shouldn't look at race. We shouldn't look at where we come from. And so that's holding a lot of us back as black lawyers, because you got to be effective in representing your clients, you got to look at who the people are and know your enemy for who your enemy is, as opposed to a smiling face with a black robe on who is still practicing institutional racism. And let me ask you this real fast, Brother Gerald, since I have you on this topic. Can you talk to us about the attacks on responsible black leadership in your city? I do know that you have a black district attorney who is a female, Kim Gardner, and we've spoke about her before on our shows, and she's under attack because it, you know, seems like she tried to make some reforms and give some fair treatment to black people in the city. Is that what you've seen, or do you have anything you can share with us on that case?
Kim Gardner, she was the first African-American elected to the position. We've had female, we call it, or district attorneys call it circuit attorney here because we are in judicial circuits. So we've had female circuit attorneys before. She's the first black. It was special to me because, you know, I ran for circuit attorney twice back in 2000. And to be a part of that whole progression, you know, to eventually have one is exciting. But Kim came into office, and being a prosecutor is a thankless job. And you never know what's going to happen because you cannot predict human nature. So you never know what somebody's going to do in your jurisdiction. I'm sure Bob McCullough in St. Louis County wished Michael Brown had been killed in the city and not in his jurisdiction. KMS Radio, one of the number one news radio stations in St. Louis, and the newspaper, the Post-Dispatch, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, had a story on the – they led with stories about the governor, Brighton's having an affair and having the woman tied up in the basement and taking some pictures to blackmail her. How can Kim ignore that story? She just got elected to prosecutor.
Okay.
And it's on the front page. So she opened up an investigation. And she subsequently ended up charging them. I don't know if she had the picture or not. That would be the only part. You know, I wasn't in the office, so I don't know all the details of the case. I will say I would have done the investigation. I probably would have wanted the picture to charge him because he's a governor. It's hard to make that call if you're not in there looking at everything. But at any rate, she went forward to charge him. He hired some of the most powerful known white attorneys in the city, high profile, Scott Rosenblum, Dowd, from Dowd and Bennett. Everybody in that family are attorneys, so going back to grandfather and federal judges. And then another former judge, Garvey, and another attorney, Jim Martin. And it was like the dream team representing the governor. And they came to Kim and they said, you know, if you don't drop the charges, we'll destroy you. And she didn't drop the charges. She moved forward. As a matter of fact, they uncovered another investigation with some issues going on with a not-for-profit he had where he had taken a donor list and was using it to raise money. And so it was like, you know, raising this dark money off the donor list from his not-for-profit. So he had two cases going. And it was actually that donor list case that caused him to resign. And because Kim ended up dropping her case because they charged her investigator, Tisby, with lying in a deposition. and said they were going to make her a witness because she was sitting in the deposition. She should have never been sitting in the deposition, but that's because when you new in power and you black, and Kim sometimes I think had trust issues, you know, and then some of the other people around her didn't want to go in there that should have been, I think. She should have never been in the room. Not that it's any kind of violation. It's just the fact that she is the circuit attorney, so somebody else should have been in the room, and they didn't want to. And, you know, Kim, I'll go. You know what I'm saying? But you can't always be. And you know this, Pam. That's a So St. Louis movie.
Okay.
But nonetheless, so they set out to attack her because Greitens had to resign. In exchange for her dropping the case on the dark money, he would resign. And that's what happened. And ultimately, that's why he resigned. But Greitens was a rising star in the Republican Party. He was on the Republican Governor's Executive Committee, and they had planned on him becoming the president. And she derailed their career, and they have been on her ever since. But it's also made her, you know, back to what I said with my grandmother, with a lump of coal don't become a diamond without pressure, because the pressure has turned her into a diamond. She was a diamond, we know that, but you know, that pressure has really, you know, made her like a folk hero now. This last election, she won by the largest. She got more votes than everybody in the election put together.
Wow. Yeah. And
she's a
60
Minutes interview. It's made her like a rock star. And she's steadily fighting. You know, we had a hearing. The special, listen to this, and then I'm gonna let it go. I told you they charged her investigator with perjury, and I want both of you all to listen to this. Nobody in Missouri has ever been charged with lying in a deposition. They're saying that during the depo, he was taking notes, a video of the interview he was doing. They're saying during the interview, he was taking notes, and when they deposed him, he said he wasn't taking notes. His thing is that he was following an outline because he's an FBI agent. And he's checking stuff off on his outline as he goes. And they said they should have privilege to that. They should have that. And that he lied. And they took a complaint. Greitens' defense attorneys took a complaint to the police department. The police department took it to the city council's office. And the city council took it to the presiding judge and had a special prosecutor appointed. And then that special prosecutor prosecuted Tisby for lying. A perjury, lying at a deposition. And so that case has been going on all through COVID, and he's billed the city $600,000, and now he wants to be relieved from the case. He argued a motion last week to be dismissed from the case, saying that this case ain't gone to trial yet. It's taking too much time. He has other pressing matters that he needs to attend to, and he wants to be let off the case, and they'll appoint another special prosecutor. Now, Jermaine and Dan Daly, attorney from Dallas, who is representing Tisby up here, Dan Daly argued that he should not be let out the case. And if you let him out the case should be dropped. Everybody should be out, and it should be over. That motion was argued last Thursday. They also found out through Tisby's investigation, Tisby found the donor list, the secret donor list, that Greitens was raising money off of. It turns out several of the major donors on the secret donor list are represented by Carmody, the special prosecutor. So Dan raised that issue for the first time in the hearing last Thursday, and Carmody blew up. He had a fit. Talking about how he was disparaging his reputation, and he couldn't believe it in that. Because we had the courtroom full of people, but that's because we already knew that they were going to be arguing this motion, and wanted to see and have a presence. It would have been more people, but because of COVID protocol, it was less. And he's talking about, and you brought all these people in here. Dan doesn't even know. He came from Dallas. He doesn't know any of those people.
Yeah.
So, and Dan is an excellent motion attorney, and he's trying to be professional and deal with it. So he wants to talk to Carmody after the hearing, you know, by himself. Because we hanging around.
Okay.
He's like, I'm hanging around. So I want to talk to Carmody. So I say, all right, I'm going out in the hallway. He go to talk to Carmody. Carmody tell him, your day is coming. You're going to get yours.
Wow. And you know what, Attorney Christmas, so you're giving us one black man's perspective about the view from the courtroom. And so that's kind of a scenario on how things happen for black people versus how things are happening with white people, right? So very interesting. You keep us posted on what's going on with St. Louis and the attack, I guess, against the black prosecutor, because prosecutors can be important that they be fair because they do account for a lot of the cases. So let's go ahead and go to, I want to talk about the promotion of the gangster lifestyle impact and how do we see peer pressure and the dare culture being pushed in our community, how that affects what you see with some of your clients, you know, with our people, because, again, we're looking at these young people coming in these courts, and we want the black man's perspective. What is it that they need to know? What is it that they need to be doing when this influence is sometimes leading to criminal incarceration? Yep, Brother Deshaun, I mean, with the juveniles, they're very influenced by this culture. So what do we see? Does that lead to some of what we're seeing in these courts?
Most definitely. They're trying to impress. And a lot of the stuff they're doing is just trying to impress their peers. I used to get a lot of juveniles who would end up, I'd have to argue with the prosecutor about whether or not they're in a gang because they just made up a gang, because they wanted to impress somebody and say that they were in one. What has your gang done? Absolutely nothing. But a collection of black people is often a gang. And so we used to have that fight on a regular basis in the courts that I'm in. I don't often see that much anymore, but that was a huge problem for a long time, was the allegation of gang affiliation. But so much that's done by juveniles is really just pretending for their friends. You'll see people in, you know, doing stuff on Instagram or on social media just to get attention that has absolutely nothing to do with who they really are. And if you saw the rest of the picture, it would make sense. But I, not too long ago, had a case where a juvenile was holding up guns like he was the biggest thug there ever was. He's in the car with his parents. They're his parents' guns, but the only part of the picture you see is him holding up the gun. He's on social media showing off, and they're just letting him. Things like that tend to be used against. We also have to. We have to teach our children. We have an obligation, and our obligation is to be always found trying to teach them right. We can't allow them to just be, we can't pretend like our children don't have enemies, because the court system is often an enemy of our children. And so we have to be realistic. We can't let them just act the fool on social media as though there won't be any ramifications and no one will ever see that, because it's not a secret.
Yeah, that's right. And I know district attorneys and circuit attorneys all over this country, they have rooms that have social media cases and forms. They have the people's information as part of investigation. Isn't that correct, Attorney Christmas? They using the social media the brother is describing as evidence against them. So we really do need to encourage our people to not let their children play games and live out their little fantasies that oftentimes are just nothing but imagination. And conflict resolution is so important. That's one of the things we have in the nation. We bring in conflict. You know, we're teaching each other how to get along, how to act as in unity, and that's something that is really needed in the community. I do agree, in these family courts, in these criminal courts, unity and conflict resolution skills are so very important. So I wanted to go back, though, to Derek Chauvin and that particular, his sentence. What do we think? Was that fair? Was that what we expected? Can you weigh in on what we saw? Everybody saw it on TV. We saw the heinous murder of our brother George Floyd. We saw the charging of Derek Chauvin. We saw him get this full trial, and then we saw the sentencing. So as black attorneys, from a black man's perspective, what do you all think? What's your opinion?
I would say that the fact that the murder, we saw it from his own video. If there were anyone else who had committed this, if one of us had committed this, there would be no question, and the trial would have taken maybe a day. There was never any questions about what happened. We saw it from multiple viewpoints.
You trying to get out?
I'm sorry? Oh. But the fact that it took that long should tell us that nothing about this was really about justice. The only thing that made him be found guilty was the reality that people were afraid if he wasn't found guilty, people were going to burn up the city. Mm. It was fear that forced them to find him guilty. And it was that same fear that forced them to give him the little bit of a sentence that he got. If that were not there, we've seen too many times that sentence wouldn't have occurred.
Yeah.
It was the people's unity that forced that sentence, and that's all it was.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good perspective. I know you see the type of intentional, what appeared to be very abusive treatment and cold conduct by Chauvin, and you see that sentence. The Floyd family is quoted as saying that it was a slap on the wrist. And I do agree. I think that was a slap on the wrist. As we're moving on, Attorney Christmas, did you want to add anything?
It was about what I expected. I was thinking he was going to get somewhere in between 20 and 30 years, and he ended up getting, 22?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think he had to do 18 of those.
Yeah.
So I figured it was going to be that something around that number. And we know it was the fear. I totally agree. The situation where fear was good. But we knew it was going to be the fear that I think should not have had to go through the trauma we had to go through to get to this point. Because we had to watch George Floyd die, in front of us. Nobody should have to endure that. And then through the trial, as one juror said, every day they had to come in and watch it again. So, we had to watch it over and over. In order to get to where we got, we had to watch him die over and over again. All of us saw it at least 10, 15 times, everybody. So that's a lot of watching somebody die consistently. And I wonder what is the trauma of that, or is that necessary in order to help us understand? Because I do believe that, God is always working and using his influence to move us in the right direction. And so you just often wonder, is that what it's going to take and what's necessary? And what you all were saying earlier is that we do have a paranoid community because we're just not that – this – I love the courage – of the young people. A lot of the music I do actually like. It can be raunchy, and it can be vulgar, and it's problematic because we have these young impressionable minds, and we can't lose our sense of dignity and respect. And it seems like we have lost a part of that, just wanting to have pride, and I don't know where we lost that, but we got to bring that whole movement back. It reminds me of, did you see James Brown when I think King was assassinated? He wanted to put on the concert, and everybody wanted to jump on the stage. And, you know, he made everybody get down and say, you know, we're going to act like we got some sense and some decency. And then I think right after that he recorded Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Yeah, at that moment, we just got to get a hold of our people, you know, because we have to have, you know, just a level of pride that no matter what you're doing, it's just a pride about the way you carry and present yourself and, you know, the way that you talk to the other people and care about the other people in your community. And we have got to insist that our children do that. We have to actively parent our community, all our children, not just yours. It can't just be your biological children. It has to be everybody you come in contact with. We can't be afraid of them. We can't be afraid of our own children. That's and they want point. The guidance they're looking for, because I know anybody that works with juveniles, know once you go down there and you talk to them in the justice center and the jail, they revert. They're just children.
Yes, that is so true.
And they suck it up. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
They want to know, when you coming back? You come to see me, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, that is so right. That is so right. Yeah.
You know, you leave
like
out
you
like, boy, these just some children.
Yeah, caught up in some very
no
life
how
changing.
Hard they seem.
Right.
That's
no
right.
matter how hard they seem, they're just some children.
Caught up in these torture chambers now with these mm-hmm. life-changing decisions that they've made. And but then we got to remember the predatory nature of the system, because as you were talking, Brother Christmas, it reminded me of what the minister said in an article entitled God Has Come to Answer Our Cry for Justice. And in one of the quotes, he says, when you are not man or woman enough to run your affairs, you live under somebody's dictates other than your own. You know, and he talks about how we're sitting around asking the white man to respect us as a man.
I know.
But we think like little boys, you know, and that's something. I think as black attorneys, you all have to balance that in a system that is primarily white. But still, the fight for justice, the standing up, the battle, the long hours that you all work is so very important. And that's what we want people to understand about you all as black men today. I'm going to take this call. I'm going to take a call from Sister Donna Muhammad, and then we can go back. Let's see. Sister Donna, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam to this esteemed panel of attorneys. I just had a quick comment, and then I had a question for your panelists, for the attorneys. The first,
yes,
I wanted to just quickly thank Attorney Christmas as you dealt with the grand jury and opening it, because I, like other people I knew, I always, you know, it just sounded so prestigious, grand jury. Not realizing that it was really just a secretive, closed area that can be led in whatever direction you want it. So I thank you, because this program is doing exactly what it was established to do, which is to educate us and empower us. So thank you for that.
Praise
and then the point that Brother Deshaun made about pointing out to our parents that letting them get arrested is not teaching a lesson. That's not the proper discipline. For punishment, that was really, really profound, and I really, you know, I'm trying to find a way to share that clip all over the place, because that is ingrained in us. Okay, it'll do them good, let them do it, not knowing what we are setting them up for once they're entangled in this. So I really thank you for that, and teaching them, you know, close your mouth sometimes, because, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, as black people, we keep our mouths open a little bit too much. So my question, you all just spoke about your thoughts on the sentencing of Officer Chauvin. And I wanted to know what you thought about the statements. I don't know if you had a chance to see it today, but the statement that he made to the family, and the analyst alluded to the fact that it may relate to a plea deal down the road that could potentially carry, you know, 25 years but serve concurrently. And it had to do with a civil case and him acknowledging or apologizing what he did to George Floyd. So I just kind of wanted to hear your weigh in on that. And that was all. Thank you for this quality programming.
Oh, thank you so much, Sister Donna.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. That I appreciate that. And I think that's normal. You have to realize that he is represented by counsel. And so you're going to have, if he has other stuff pending, that's what his lawyer is supposed to do, attempt to see if he can get some plea deals and have him do some things necessary to lower the sentence. That's the way. We don't have a – I think people get – they misunderstand. We don't have a justice system. We have a legal system. And that's how our legal system works. Oftentimes you think you're going to come there for justice. You might get it sometimes. Most of the time you don't. Sometimes you do. A lot of times you do. Just all depends. It's a case-by-case situation, but it's a legal system. No guarantee justice.
Yeah. Yeah, and it reminds me. Go ahead, Brother Deshaun.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to thank Sister Donna for her comment, but my former business partner and I were talking about him trying to seek a deal at this point also, and it's so funny that he's trying to seek a deal after he's already been sentenced. There was never any talk of a deal prior to that. And the question is, what does he have to offer? Who cares about his statements at this point? He's been sentenced. He's been found guilty. We know what happened. We watched it repeatedly, as Brother said. What could he possibly offer anybody? His apology is worthless because he didn't offer it until he knew he was going to do, hopefully, at least 18 years in prison. So it's not sincere. A plea deal usually involves, usually there's someone with something to offer. There's some information out there. Prosecution is not 100% sure of its case. A number of reasons why plea deals might be made, even if it's just for efficiency. But in this case, what could he possibly offer? What do we not know? Had he pre-planned to kill him?
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Because the leveraging ability that he has is strictly none. I didn't think he had any going into the actual trial because of the severity of his actions and the evidence that was put before him. But it kind of goes back to what you all talked about earlier, which is the I see myself advantage that white people have in their system, and perhaps some sympathy that is given to each other that is not offered. For me, I think the Chauvin trial did show what happens when a defendant is given a trial, a full trial. His constitutional rights are protected, because this is not what we see with brothers. This is not what we see with sisters who enter these systems, because there's a report from the Innocence Project, and this is in this Lying and Locking Up Children article that Brother Michael Z. Muhammad and Brother Naba Muhammad wrote in The Final Call. And they talk about how in this era of racial strife, the police, prosecutors, defense attorney, judges, and jurors were almost always white. And so when you have the actual problems and the improprieties, it's usually the, they say, cross-racial misidentifications, forced confessions, all-white juries, and blatant racism led to wrongful convictions of countless innocent black people. So it seems like the problem is mainly when it's a black person in the white judicial justice system, or even when it's in the civil system where we're looking for the actual returns, the verdicts. And so I totally agree with you. Did anybody want to weigh in on how the system and the prosecutors being white is usually the factor when we see a lot of this blatant non-neutrality, is what I said from the beginning? They're admitting that they can't be neutral when it comes to dealing with black people. And we call that systemic racism that's in the system. So did anybody want to make any comments on that?
That's weaved into the fabric of the criminal justice system.
Okay.
Starting off with the Constitution. And then even when you go to the 13th Amendment. And so having that ability, you know, to imprison people has always gone through racial lines. That's always, and it will be. So we just have to drill down and know that, try as best we can to live with pride, to pull ourselves away from some of these systems. We play a role too, and we have to take responsibility for what we can do ourselves, because that would significantly help with moving our people away from the legal system in the criminal justice aspect. You know, we need to be more on and dealing in other issues and areas of the law, and not concentrated in criminal justice issues, and remove some of that trauma out of our communities. But it's inherent, and that's why they look at Chauvin the way that they do, because he is one of them, and law enforcement. And we know whenever it's involved, like I talked about in the grand jury, whenever it's law enforcement, it's going to be flipped. It's going to be totally different than what it ever has been before. The only thing I think that he might could possibly offer is if he's ready to, I'm sure in his time period on that force, he's seen a lot. And, you know, it could be some unsolved murders that he knows about that they could, other people could have been complicit with. That I'm wondering if he's trying to share information like that. Because, you know, I'm sure so much dirt has happened, so much illegalities in that department that he's aware of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably some real substantial cases if we lived in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, because I know Attorney Christmas, there was a case involving black man. You know, this goes around how when people arrive at crime scenes, and sometimes these guns appear, or sometimes weapons appear, or different things that incriminate defendants after they've been murdered by the police. You know, can you share with us any of that type of, you know, because you're a criminal defense attorney, so we know that sometimes the incident reports are written in such a way that may or may not reflect the facts that really existed at the scene. So,
whoever controls the crime scene controls the narrative, and that's the problem. You know, in our case with Vondarrion Myers, who was shot in South St. Louis, you know, the officer's right there that is the main one that's involved, the perpetrator. The next person he calls, those two, you know, they can control the scene for whenever whoever else arrives. And many times the officers will stage the scene because they'll have a throwdown weapon. Usually they had a throwdown weapon around their ankle. It's like at the bottom of their pants, right up under there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll have a gun that they can throw down, and they can stage the crime scene. And it happens quite often. And that's the problem. And there's no way to get ahead of that, because they caused the incident. So, of course, they're the first on the scene. Even if another agency comes in, they can already have the scene staged by the time that agency gets there. And it'll follow their narrative. You know, if you control the crime scene, you control the narrative. And that's what happens. We talked about George Floyd. We all know. But for it being videotaped, we would have never known. The story that he gave about him having a medical issue would have been unquestioned. Unquestioned.
Wow.
We know that for a fact. The only thing and the only reason why is because their young girl had the courage to stand there and videotape it. Without her courage, it would have never happened. It would have went on just like it was reported. That's a perfect example of it. Perfect example.
Yeah.
And everybody on this call knows it, and everybody in the country knows it, too, the practice law.
You know that had it not been for the filming and the George Floyd case, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been a regular homicide. They just they would have believed the story that they put. They said he had a medical issue. I forgot how they termed it, medical emergency or medical condition, however they termed it. And I think they said they found a substance in this system. Yes, it would have just been just, it wouldn't even been questioned. Not at all.
Yeah.
I got a no-knock search warrant that we filing on tomorrow. It happened in 2017. It wasn't questioned. A veteran, they come into his house and kill him. You know what I'm saying? And he has a drug house. And it's a no-knock search warrant. But in 2017, nobody's paying attention. But now, it was like God is good. Because now everybody pays attention to no-knock. So, matter of fact, the Washington Post is coming in to interview us tomorrow. It's like no-knock search warrants is a big thing.
And, again, so we know as listeners, a no-knock search warrant, can you give us a brief, just what is that?
That's when law enforcement, they will go – they generally take a probable cause statement and seek a warrant from a judge in order to execute a search warrant. And, you know, normally they have to knock and announce themselves, you know, knock on the door, police, open up, we have a search warrant, police, open the door, some kind of knocking and then announcing themselves. And it depends on the state, but a pause before they go to the residence if nobody comes and opens the door. So in other situations, they ask for it. They say that, you know, it's a lot of drug activity going on or their guns. It's a dangerous setting. They ask for a no-knock search warrant because they feel like if they knock and they let these people know their lives could be in danger, they could get away or get rid of the contraband. So they file an affidavit asking for a no-knock search warrant, which is what they did with Brown and Taylor, where they get to the house and they just bust in. They don't announce or anything. And that's what they did in the Breonna Taylor case where her boyfriend thought that it was an intruder because they just came busting in. And with my client, they did the same thing. He was an elderly man, though. And
how old was he? How old was this man?
75.
A 75-year-old man.
And he had just been to the doctor that day. And if you know anything about taking care of seniors, you know, when they go to the doctor, they usually go to the doctor, they go to the grocery store, they pick up their medicine. It's a big day. And when they get home, they're ready to get into bed and, you know, just rest. And that's what he had done. And he lived in it was a high drug traffic area. And a confidential informant had told them that drug sales was going on in that house. But they have a duty to do due diligence. And if they'd done any type of due diligence, they would have known that Don was not selling drugs, no hand-to-hand transactions going on with him. Matter of fact, he's on a security company, and he was adamant about no drugs on his property.
Okay.
And they went in three houses. His was the last one. And they just busted in with a flash bomb. He jumped up, they believe he's reaching for a gun and shot him.
This is what they said. This is what they said. And did he live? Did he die?
No, Don died.
He died. And the thing is, no-knock search warrants are used primarily in black communities. Isn't that the fact, attorneys? A lot of these.
And they always use, let me say this one last thing, Pam, and then I will listen to everybody. But in the city, they always use the SWAT team. And most of the SWAT people are former military. Who've been, they have PTSD. They have been over in war zones. And they, in order to self-therapy on their PTSD, they want to work on SWAT and they want to work in the black community. So they reenact. They want to reenact their wartime experience. And that's an issue in our communities all across the country. Look for those officers. Most of those officers are former military, and a lot of them have PTSD issues.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's awful. Well, keep us posted on that case. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it reminds you of the editorial written in the final call, out of control cops can't hide behind crime problem. And the thing is that police accountability, according to this article, institutions like the Post, most white voters and police unions, they never really wanted police accountability. And so now as they're crying about, oh, my gosh, all this whatever in the communities, Do we think they really wanted accountability? And anybody can weigh in on that, because we're talking about these abuses that seem to be very common in our judicial system, from you all's perspective, from a black man's perspective, as well as this black woman who's sitting here. So did anybody want to weigh in further?
Yeah. I would say, you know, Mr. Christmas spoke about how the you asked about does having white people at every stage affect the outcome, and Mr. Christmas addressed it, you know, from a historical standpoint. But I would say it's definitely an issue, and I would say from an institutional standpoint, because every stage in the process, if you begin with the police officer, every stage in the process, if there were a black person who were familiar with the community and who had love for the community, somebody could step in and address this, from the officers to the whoever vets the cases, to the prosecutor, to the defense attorney, to the judge. If at any stage there's somebody in there who has love for the community, then we could address some of these issues that we deal with. And in terms of, do people want accountability? There's no need for accountability outside of our neighborhood, because you don't hear of these issues happening outside of our neighborhood. If
wow.
something like this happens in a white neighborhood, it's an anomaly. 9 times out of 10, it was an accident, an actual accident, as opposed to, like the brother said, we have, it's not so much PTSD issues in terms of them having their therapy for PTSD. They essentially never leave the war zone. They get combat vets, put them in our neighborhood, and the training is to essentially tell them that you're still in a war zone, get to work, soldier. They're not policing the community. It's a war zone for them.
Yeah.
And that's the mindset that's approached in our neighborhood. But you don't have that mindset in other communities. We don't get the officer who, you know, draws hopscotch numbers and stuff on the sidewalk for children. We get the officers who are throwing our children up against the wall, having them spread eagle. So in terms of, do other communities want accountability? They have accountability. They have a whole other kind of policing.
Right. That's right. And even as we're talking about the issues and the way we're talking about them, we're being very forthright on this show tonight. So when we go into these courts and we tell these DAs, these prosecutors, this is what's going on, you know, this is injustice, you're violating my client's rights, you're racist, you're this, you know, are we being met with acceptance, or is this a uphill battle that is really contributing to the hours and the hundreds of hours that black lawyers have to work if we're going to be effective at all? I mean, does anybody have any of this, anything they'd like to add? I mean, I know some fine black attorneys, and you all always have to dot our I's, we have to cross our T's, we have to get evidence, we have to really fight for any kind of favorable outcomes with our clients, as well as parenting them. So we're, you know, and by parenting, what we're saying is that we know the rules, and we know how to make sure that our clients are not found just negligent because of the tricks in the legal system. because of the black codes and the pet, you know, just the petty and excessive biases that we see. So this is some hard work. I just wanted to put that out there, and you know, thank you all for your hard work. But this is a can you tell your listeners this is a really battle that most black lawyers are going into.
It is, but Sister Pam, if I can, you ask what will we tell the community? The one
right.
thing I would say from my years of experience, to whoever is going to hire a black attorney, stop lying to your lawyer.
Mm.
We have so, I don't know what the math is. I don't know. We as attorneys often have to do so much extra because our clients I've had many cases where my clients have told the police the truth before I walk into the case and will lie to me about what happened.
Mm.
Because somehow or another they have the parties mixed up in the case. So I would say we as a community have to be honest so that somebody can fight for us.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and I would say with Attorney Christmas talking about our need to economically as lawyers come together and build better institutions to represent our people, I would also say hire black lawyers for some of the really good cases that y'all come across, community. We would
Amen.
Love to get some of those. We would love to get some of those cases that you all just, you know, sometimes people willingly give, blindly give to white firms who, as I quoted earlier, they're not taking your cases if you don't have the money. They're not taking your cases if they're looking at perceived mannerisms. They just are not neutral, and most of the time we as black attorneys are. And I think as we're closing, because we're down to 7 minutes, I want to say a solution is make sure that you can talk to your attorney. Make sure you hire an attorney that will communicate with you. Don't have an attorney that never can answer your calls, that never you never see until you're going to court. I see that all too often. People accept that type of behavior from white people. They, you know, we don't do that. We have to talk to our clients. I mean, how important is it? Like Brother Deshaun said, don't lie to your lawyers. But also talk. This is why you're paying people. But you can get that kind of reception from black attorneys. So we're going to close out, and I want each of us to go around, talk to any point that was made tonight or any other information you think on some of the points that were made. And I'm going to start with you, Brother Christmas. Are you there?
I'm here.
Yes, sir. You know, so again, Yeah, black man's view from the courtroom and what we should know.
Well, you were talking about, I think, the recap, we all were clear about not talking and not making statements to the police in reference to what you were saying about black attorneys. I think we're winning. Most of the attorneys that I know that are out here practicing are getting good results for their clients. I really don't, in all honesty, run across anybody that's saying that they're unable to get good results for their clients. And so I think mm-hmm. we really have a good, strong group of black attorneys out here practicing all across the country. And, mm-hmm. You know, overall, I believe that we are winning and we're moving in the right direction. I think you're going to see us, you know, I think, you know, in all honesty with critical analysis, the only thing that I see that we need to do that we're not doing is consolidate more. You know, some of the business that we're losing is because, you know, we could not take that on by ourselves. Not that we couldn't be good at it. It just
right.
would not, you know, it would overwhelm us. And so ultimately, you know, if we want to move to the next level of economic development and move our people there, when you go back to your original quote from Charles Hamilton Houston, either you are a social engineer, you're a parasite. We got to move off of, you know, parasitic corporate economic behavior and more to, you know, teaching our people how to social engineer, how to come together collectively, cooperatively, you know, economically, and build on that. And I think that's what's going to be the next, that's the next wave I think you're going to see from us. So I'm really excited about it.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful words. Brother Deshaun, did you want to weigh in on that as well, make a closing statement? Yeah, Brother Deshaun? Okay. Yeah, so I think we've had a wonderful, wonderful conversation, because as both of these black men have shared with us so much of their insight on what they see and the beauty of their perspective as fathers, you know, as brothers. Brother Gerald, because I know you're still with us, I mean, you've done a lot of work, I know, and mentorship programs, and you mentioned 100 black men, and how important do you think those things are to aiding in the overall upliftment of our people in these communities? Yeah, and he may have left as well, but we know. Go ahead.
I actually hadn't left. I mistakenly had my I was muted. But
okay, Brother
John.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What I was trying to say was, essentially, your point was that we have to come together, and we have to do business with one another, and that's across the board. We have to know that to stay alive as a black business, we have to jump through hurdles that nobody else has to. So where Brother Christmas was saying that most of us are getting good results, it's because we do triple the work of everybody else.
Yes, sir.
We have to go and find those answers that nobody else has ever looked for. Because
that's right.
That's how we stay alive in this business. So
yes,
when you hire a black attorney, you're hiring somebody who's going to go the extra mile, because that's what we do for a living.
That's right. Yes, sir. And with the integrity and the love for the community and the vested interest, because this is our community. These are our children. These are our children's futures. We all are of this community. So I want to thank you all for listening and for joining in this panel. I thank you, Brother Gerald Christmas. I thank you, Brother Deshaun Muhammad. And I would like to thank the listeners for listening to A Time for Justice. To hear previous shows, you can go to the archive at the Elevated Places Network, and you can hear our previous shows. I would like to thank the Elevated Places Network, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, whose show comes on the Ask Dr. Ava. You can hear her show on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. And I would like to thank the Elevated Places team for all their hard work, Brother Terrence Muhammad, Sister Donna Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad, and I would thank you all once again for listening and ask that you tune in next week for more informative discussions. Remember, A Time for Justice, we air at Tuesdays at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for listening. Assalamu alaikum. This is Sister Pamela Muhammad.